Slow Burn is a production of.
There I am. Rock me like a hurricane. Ah! The song that ended the Cold War, Rock Me Like a Hurricane. Hello. I'm speaking from the back area. I've got a halo right now. Looking quite orthodox. Looking like a vision from heaven descended onto earth to judge the wicked and the righteous. But no, it's just golden time here in the backyard. So off the bat, just want to clarify something for some people after the last stream I did with Chris, where we were back here batting it back, and I talked about how we want to do that on, in the office with maybe some games thrown in. I won't be doing that and not doing solo streams. I won't do necessarily as many, but I will still try to do at least one or two a week, even if we do stuff with the office and the video game rig. So don't worry. If you still like me staring puzzledly into the chat and not saying anything, and kind of just staring and hearing some birds chirp and somebody hooting and hollering and a siren, and then I say something about the Noid, don't worry. That'll still be available. I mean, I'm obviously imagining it being Wet Ass Party, you know, and the reference being the popular song of the moment and the grand old party. So, it's two adjectives. Someone asked if there's a dialectical resolution of the CGI practical effects problem, and sadly, not in the way that you're imagining, not in the way that we would want. I think the way it gets solved is people just don't. That's all they expect, and the context becomes one where everything is like that, and so good and bad are contained within the concept of digital. So. It'll be beside the point. So that's the way it's going to resolve. Like a way of keeping them both vital, impossible, because of the money. Like even having real guns, somebody told me after I was talking about Squibs that it's almost impossible to have actual firearms on movie sets anymore. Like the reason that they just have them pretend to have recoil and then put in the flashes and the sounds later is that those aren't real guns. They're rubber guns. Because the insurance and the price of having a guy on set who can secure the firearm are prohibitive. Prohibitive from the point of view of making the movie profitable, which is, of course, the only consideration. And with that being the case, it'll never make economic sense to have real guns on the set. There's no aesthetic argument you can make that can overturn the basic math. So I'm afraid it shan't be happening as much as we'd like to imagine it. I mean, what do you mean? You mean like, oh, you know, after a while they just started CGI-ing the guns entirely. And now I really want those movies where they have the rubber gun. Oh, those are the really good ones. Yeah, when they're having the rubber gun and pretending to have recoil, that's so much better than the CGI guns that fake recoil themselves. You can tell. And that becomes the remnant of the practical effects culture. Apparently there was a shooting at the White House. I'm honestly stunned that's the first time this has happened, just because of how high the temperature is politically in the last 4 years. People took a shot at Bill Clinton like every 2 weeks. There was a guy, I remember a video of it, there was this guy who showed up with a fucking trench coat and a fucking, or maybe I'm imagining the trench coat, but it was definitely a semi-auto, and he just raked the side of the White House while running back and forth before he got tackled. And that was only one of like two or three. And then there was a guy who landed an airplane on the White House lawn during his presidency. It's weird. Now that everything is so much more intense and politics is so much more polarized and has an edge of conflict to it and so much more dominant of people's day-to-day lives and self-conceptions than it was in the 90s, very few people have tried to take a shot at Trump. Maybe it's because extreme, like, paranoid mindsets that get activated by politics would not, almost by definition, be activated against Trump, but I can't believe that's true. There've got to be some people who have oriented their psyche to an unhealthy degree against Donald Trump. And yet, nobody, until whoever this is, and we don't even know what the deal is. Who knows? What country has the best shape? I always thought Chile was sort of adorable. It's like, how the hell is that a country? What are you doing? Somebody asked, how do you understand, how do you explain the idea that I've said a while ago, and I don't even know if I would necessarily even agree with this now that I've, like, refined my thinking on things, that consciousness, you're conscious to the degree that you perceive time. And I would say, just as a quick example of what I mean by that, I can't really elaborate because, like I said, I'm not sure, I'm still working on all this stuff. But, so, there, like, The matrix of reality, the universe, whatever you want of it, is composed of energy, right? It's just energy. It's one substance moving at different speeds, i.e. it's matter and time. Those are the two things. It's matter and time. It's energy transferring through states. And there are objects in space. There are inanimate objects in space. They experience no time. Lower orders of animals experience the present and a bit of the past, and humans, because of their ability to take a bunch of information in, turn it into memories and associations and patterns, eventually can perceive or at least imagine the future, which allows them to move in what they imagine to be free will. Because they're moving towards a future that they have pictured in their head. So they can perceive future as a axis of time in a way that less evolved animals can't. And it is a continuum, of course, from human down. It's not and or. So it's degree two. That's what I mean. But of course they're all the same thing. It's just objects perceive them in different ways, or fail, or don't perceive them. I just watched The Hidden a month or so ago. It was awesome. I still don't think Kyle MacLachlan's a good actor, but that movie rules, and it's just a smorgasbord of practical effects and real car chases in a movie that couldn't have been more than a couple million-dollar budget in the 80s. I did see Cube, and I gotta say, that movie's reputation rests, it seems to me, almost entirely on the scene where the guy gets chopped up by the wires, because the rest of the movie has barely any Cube ownage at all. It's just a bunch of people with Canadian accents yelling at each other, and then narrowly avoiding getting chopped into cubes. Did not enjoy. Over-delivered by the people who had previously praised it, so... It's No The Blob, which I just rewatched last night because people were reminding me of The Blob. I will watch the new Dune movie. I'll watch the new Dune movie on like a fucking on an Apple Watch or whatever. That and Tenet. It's going to be great. Kamala just unfollowed Biden. I saw that. Girl, I need the tea. Someone spill it. I gotta say, if they don't pick her, I will be surprised, because that seems like the smart move. And they're really just playing prevent defense here, which is kind of surprising. So I kind of still think it will be them. It will be her, just because it's the what they would perceive as the lowest, the highest percentage play, in that it has the lowest chance of having a spectacular or unintended negative consequence. Whereas Kamala Harris doesn't change anything or make anything interesting, but that's, in their mind, enough. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be Mayor Pete. It would be hilarious, because all the people who have been saying, you know, Biden's intersectional, Biden is listening to women, and he has to listen to women and all that, or he has to recognize BLM, and have a black or a female or both VP, they will... I don't even know if they'll even be able to have 1 second of expressed public anger, because the immediate question will be, what are you going to do about it? And the answer is nothing. They're not going to do a fucking thing. They can't do shit. They've already said that. I do hope it's somebody from left field, because Kamala is just such a boring pick. I'm already snoozing thinking about it. Give me somebody interesting. Yeah, I think... Pete, I mean, I'm assuming that Pete got offered a relatively high cabinet spot for his, endorsement and dropping out when he was in second place. I mean, there is logic to it. It wasn't just strong arming, because I think anybody with eyes could see that even though Mayor Pete was doing well in some sort of, in just the sense of his performance to that point, that he pretty clearly had no path forward. He just did not have any support outside of upper, like middle and upper class white people. And that never changed. The hope was maybe a surprise Iowa win could like win people over, but it didn't happen. People were still stuck in with Biden. So it was you could argue that it was a rational response, but he certainly wouldn't have done it for anything less than a significant offer. Maybe defense. I mean, he'd want something in the cabinet, because he knows he can't get he will not win another office in Indiana. He cannot win a statewide race in Indiana, and at this point, Congress is sort of a step down. He's not just the descendant of a Gramsci scholar. A Gramsci scholar was his dad. Apparently not a very good Gramsci scholar, but I have no first-hand knowledge. Just passing along tea that I heard and then spilled. I sipped it, then I spilled it. What would it take for a glue Indiana? Indiana's gone, folks. It's ahead. It's gone. In Ohio is going to turn into Indiana. It's a demographic thing. Like, the young people move out of the state, leaving only a shrinking core of older and older, empty nest, white, rural, and suburban people. And over time, they're going to get more and more Republican. So, yeah, Ohio's going to turn into Indiana. I mean, if we're able to pull off an election with any kind of legitimacy to it in November, and I think that is a significant if, and I have no idea what that would mean. And Biden wins big, wins back Florida, hell, wins Arizona. He could win Arizona, I think, and even Georgia maybe, and lose Ohio. I mean, there is a real thing, there is a real consequence to all the young, college-educated white people who make up that young cadre who is supposed to save us from our older reactionary citizens, that they all move to the same cluster of blue state big cities. Is it states like Ohio slowly get drained of everybody but the most recrudescent remainder? The ones who don't move to Arizona anyway. Indiana was always a Republican state, but I think I'm just saying Ohio is in the direction of turning towards there. Because Ohio used to have Ohio had that Rust Belt upper area, Cleveland and such, with its white ethnic Democrats. Glasses versus contacts, that's not a hard one. I've never worn contacts. I never got them. I never got a subscription or prescription for contacts. Never worn contacts. Never had any desire to stick my finger in my eyeball. You got to imagine if Biden does win that people are going to take shots at him all the time. There's going to be a Q guy with a fucking, like a bunch of fire extinguishers strapped to his chest, jumping at him at every public event. I do think if Trump does pull something in the election around mail-ins or something, you could see an actual secessionist movement start. I don't think it would be anything like what you'd see if Biden wins in terms of military brinksmanship, but I think you would see like an attempt by big state blue governors to sort of create a state within a state to establish, as they call it, real dual power. And become co-equal to the government, to the federal government, if not exceeding it in authority, which would then raise a specter of conflict. Be interesting. I would never do LASIK. My God, lasering my eyeballs? No, thank you. Party of zero for that. Spicy ketchup? You're talking about fucking. You're talking about barbecue sauce. Ketchup is ketchup. I do think it would be funny though, and this is a real possibility. Trump just steals the thing the way everyone sees him setting out to do, and people just go, no. And like the entire media freaks out, right, because it's mostly anti-Trump and pro-norms. The entire media goes nuts. Half the country freaks out. And then everyone is waiting for someone else to do something, and he just does it. And nothing, and it's like, well, I mean, no one actually, everyone said it was awful, but nobody made any kind of coherent movement to stop it. And so it just happened. Wow, that's crazy. Someone's asking about the Taiping Rebellion, a fascinating event. Something like 30 million people die in the 1860s in China, basically because a guy failed the SATs and freaked out. A guy who wanted to be a bureaucrat in the Manchu state, which was basically the only way that you could get out of the peasant class. One of the very few, anyway, was to take this series of rigorous exams, which basically involved memorizing Confucian texts and then repeating them. He failed it. He failed it a bunch of times, and then he failed it one too many times, and he had a complete breakdown, and he was in a bed for months with a fever and hallucinations. And at the end of it, he announced that he was Jesus Christ's younger Chinese brother, and that it was his duty to unify China under his rule, to create a heavenly kingdom on earth. And he set about organizing the landless Hakka peasantry of southern China, which are people who had historically lived in the northern part of China, but been driven south over the years by mostly the conflict with the steppe tribes over the successive centuries, and become a rural proletariat, the closest thing you could call one anyway, in southern China. And he was able to organize him around his weird syncretic Christianity, but also along the axis of expelling, of redistributing land to the peasants and expelling the Manchu king rulers, because the Qing dynasty was not ethnically Han. The Qing dynasty had been one of those steppe tribes in Manchuria that had actually been invited into China to help keep the, I think, the Ming Empire from falling. And then over the course of their intervention, they just took over because they were the stronger party. And they were the ones who instilled the hair is mandatory for men, and, you know, and discriminated against, especially in government, against Han to some degree. And those motivations worked, and they ended up creating this gigantic peasant army that established a multi-year imperium in central China. And this is around the same time that the empire was getting torn apart. Was being opened up at the barrel of a cannon to foreign trade by the Opium Wars, and there were also simultaneous outbreaks and revolts among Western Muslims. Red Turban, I think, not yellow. That was earlier. And it went on for years, and they conquered huge swaths of central China, and they put to flight hundreds of thousand man armies established to defeat them. But eventually they were able to. This was something that probably in Chinese history had traditionally been the pattern. The traditional Chinese historical pattern is you have a empire establish itself over some part of China and have a relatively stable social relationship for hundreds of years. Then through a lot of times it's just good old-fashioned weather change, climate shifts, but war with the steppe people or whatever, legitimacy is the mandate of heaven is lost, and there is a popular uprising that installs a new imperial line, and this was very much in line with that. And the king was about as discredited as any regime could be. But I recently read a book that makes the argument that the thing that allowed the king to persist beyond its maybe natural life cycle was Western intervention. because there was a period where the West was watching the rebellion where they were kind of sympathetic to the Taiping because, like, hey, the guy's a Christian. Hey! And the Taiping government had support in halls of government by people who, like, saw it as a way to open up China to foreign trade. And he was very... The Heavenly King was very solicitous of Western help because he thought of himself as a Christian. But it turns out he was a little bit too loopy of a Christian, and what the Western powers really wanted more than anything was continuity and stability. And they figured the easiest way to get that was by backing the Manchu. And that helped beat back a rebellion which probably, honestly, by normal circumstances, should have been successful in overthrowing the regime, or would have in the past anyway. But now China was part of a global system that allowed this exogenous force to come in and help determine things. But of course, they didn't last too much longer because first they were overthrown by Sun Yat-sen, and then the whole thing got overturned by Mao. And if you want to get too facile about it, you could say that the Chinese Communist Revolution is sort of a replaying of the Taiping in that it was an attempt to organize the landless southern peasantry, because the Hakka peasants also formed the backbone of Mao's Red Army that did the Long March and eventually won the war. Organizing them along axis of land disputes and land resentment of the landlords who dictated the life terms of this rural proletariat. But organized along a synthetic ideology that incorporates a Western ideological innovation. Christianity with the Taiping, Marxism, with the Chinese Communist Party. Was China right to wall off the internet? I would say that restrictions on the internet should not be considered some sort of horrifying imposition. They should be considered a necessary element of just public policy to maintain public well-being. Although I don't necessarily think that content should be the axis repression. It should be time accessing. I would say that needs to be choked significantly. That presents a social danger that needs to be confronted and needs to be understood to be part and parcel to the maintenance and functioning of a society. And it would be and it's felt differently. Like, think about that. Like, the Chinese-style thing where there's a ton of stuff you can't access, that feels like a actual repression. That feels like I'm being denied something. But if you do not wall off content, but you do limit time, you have functionally limited the amount of stuff you can access, the amount of the internet you can access, because you're going to have less time to do so. But it doesn't feel like as much, in my opinion, or it shouldn't feel as much like a repressive infliction on you, imposition on you, because there's still hypothetically all that out there to be accessed. But again, I don't know. That's just off the top of my head. Wouldn't that allow rich people to purchase time from people and live there forever? Okay, fine. I mean, sure. I mean, presumably, once again, none of these are proposed to be in lieu of actual socialism. So presumably you would not have like the same class of billionaire Draculas that we have now. But even if you still had income inequality, if somebody wants to pay to spend more time on the internet, you are still creating a you're still creating a rationing system. For most people, they're not going to want to spend the time, but the ones who do are going to be limited by how much money they have to do so. Yeah, people don't ask to see my feet anymore. I remember that used to be a big thing. And I will say again that you are all lucky that I resisted your importations because it would have been very nasty for everyone. Will there be another election live stream? That's a good question. It'll probably have to be in a bunker or something. But yeah, we'll probably do something. I will not be drinking rum, that much I know. I'll be White Claws only. I have found in practice that it's essentially impossible for me to really get too turned off White Claws. If I'm drinking them at a normal pace, they metabolize almost instantly, and I just get kind of a little bit of a, just a little bit of a frisson, and nothing much beyond that. So it like it's self-regulating. So I'll be balls deep in claws on election night to prevent a recap of the last unpleasantness. Yes, people are spamming that photograph, the meme of me looking. Looking quite despondent in my plastic boater. My thoughts on Belarus. Good luck and good game. I hope everyone has fun. I'm gonna do the face. I'm gonna do the sad face. Thoughts on leftists getting their shits together? Fitness, skills, mental fitness? Yes, of course. And that's all stuff you can pursue if you're not on the internet. But that's why I never tell anybody to log off completely. Because it's impossible. It's all about reclaiming time, reclaiming percentage of your day. And then having to answer the question of what to do now. There's usually something. Just too much time. It's too easy to just not have to ask the question. We should do it. We have no plans to do an Avatar episode, but you know what? I think the next time we want to do a movie, I will suggest it because I think it would be really good. Because I think I'm kind of halfway. I'm halfway to Felix because I really do think Jim Cameron is a once in a lifetime movie genius just because he is singular. There is no other director of his stature who produces the who is as involved in the production, is as much of an auteur. I guess that's the thing about Cameron is that when it comes to big budget directors, he is the single most comprehensive auteur among them. And of course, the Descartes auteur theory is very problematic, and even in his case, it's not true. But there is still something interesting and creatively, in my opinion, creatively admirable about somebody who takes on that many tasks and performs them with that level of kind of stunning facility. You know, you can make fun of his movies all you want, but there's a basic craftsmanship and skill to even his most eye-rolling endeavors that is lacking in directors who have far fewer responsibilities. Because, like, the guys you would name to go along with Cameron, Nolan, Spielberg, Lucas, maybe Guillermo del Toro, Peter Jackson for sure, not del Toro. Maybe if he'd actually done the Hobbit movie instead of running away from the project because there wasn't any room for tentacle monsters to jack anyone off. You must allow me to have the delicious tentacle creature, jack off Frodo Baggins. And also, no, it's not Frodo, it's Bilbo. Whatever, all of the hobbits and all of the orcs and all of the beautiful dwarves must be jacked off by the tentacle creature. Michael Bay is in the list. None of those guys write their own material. None of those guys write their own stuff. Maybe they contribute ideas and, like, some dialogue. I'm sure that they're all hands-on to some degree, but it's not to the degree that they get writing credits. And these guys are voracious credit seekers, so clearly they would not have... They didn't do that much. He fucking writes his own movies. Almost by himself. He creates cameras in order to get shots that he wants. No one else does it. And so therefore, you can't even compare him to anybody else. He's beyond good or evil in terms of filmmaking because he has transcended the categories by embodying, like, an entire mode of creativity that almost no one else can be said to equal. Man, that Kubrick movie would have been something. Especially because apparently it is not, as it shouldn't be, it wasn't a biopic. It was like, I think it was set, if someone can correct me if I'm wrong, it's set during the retreat from Moscow, I think. Which, perfect. That's the time. That's the time to get the guy in a moment that reflects an entire life. And with Nicholson as Napoleon, come on, that's crazy. It's good to know that he wasn't thinking of making Ryan O'Neill Napoleon, because while Ryan O'Neill can get away with being a vapid playboy with no substance, because that's what he was, he could not have pulled off Napoleon. What? It is his whole life? Fuck. Well, never mind then. That's a bad idea. I'm trying to think of where, if I was going to make a Napoleon movie, what I would want to make it about. Because, like, Retreat from Moscow makes sense, but I don't think it's what I would want it to be if I was making it. I wouldn't do Retreat from Moscow. I think I would want him in Ascent. I would want him in Ascent or at, like, a moment of greatest power. To, like, prefigure the decline rather than reflect on it. Egypt would be interesting. I think I would want something after the coup. Or maybe the coup itself. The coup is actually a really interesting story. You could do it as like a ticking clock thriller. There's a movie about Napoleon at St. Helena. I think it's called Mr. N or something with Ian Holm, if I'm not mistaken. So there's already a exiled Napoleon movie. The whiff of Grapeshot would be really interesting. The way he negotiated his spot... you could do that as like a mini tableau of his like ambition, ability, a strategic acumen, charisma, ability to spot the main chance, the ability to like triangulate, but him like negotiating the best deal out of like leading the repulsion of the riot or whatever you want to call it, the royalist rebellion, ending with him just smoking the shit out of a bunch of them. I think that would be good too. Yeah, maybe you start with him in Egypt, like where he's. Yeah, okay. I think this is what I would want to do. You start in Egypt with him selling this failure of the siege of Acre as a triumph as he like marches back into Cairo in defeat. But like, yeah, no, this was awesome. We're doing great. And then he negotiates his way out at like, hey guys, we're coming back. It's going to be great. And so you've got like the knowledge that he's not going to come back and the absurdity of it, but then also just how no one doubts it because of his magnetic charisma. Then he gets back, and then the middle of the movie could be him negotiating with like Abi Sayyas and Bara. Bara would be an amazing character in a film. And then yeah, ends with like the third act is the coup, with his, like the part with his brother saving his ass, the whole thing. I think that'd be good. That'd be interesting. But I think if I was going to do a movie about, about like 16, 1700s, like early modern period, I would do it about Bacon's Rebellion. 1676. And one of the top reasons I would like that, somebody reminded me of a field in England, and this would kind of be like the idea would be like I think maybe a more politically pointed American field in England, because the soldiers who went to suppress Bacon's Rebellion, which was a early cross-racial, like proto-proletarian revolt among indentured servants and like the early social flotsam that would turn into the American proletariat, rebelling against colonial authority, before the racial caste system had really been established, where you saw like you know actual cross-racial cooperation. The British soldiers who went to suppress it, they literally got whacked out on a hallucinogenic poisonous weed called Jimson weed or Devil's weed. And I wanted to read this quote about one of the commanders about the troops. He says, "It was a very pleasant comedy, for they turned natural fools upon it for several days. One would blow up a feather in the air, another would dart straws at it with much fury, and another, stark naked, would sit up in a corner like a monkey, grinning and making mows of them." I think that would be interesting. But of course, the other part of it is that Bacon's Rebellion was also motivated by a desire to be more in conflict with the native tribes. So, class is funny in America. So you'd have that part of it too, of course. I think you can make a very good comedy about Prince Rupert of the Rhine, because he was a classic kind of a opera bouffe, just rich Fauntleroy. He fought, he was brave, but it was a classic thing where these guys, the concept of chivalry had so lobotomized them that they couldn't distinguish behaviors by anything other than their personal whiff of grandeur. He blew at least one battle in the English Civil War because he just wouldn't stop his guys. He just kept charging off the field. I have to watch. Someone's asking about Von Trier. I like Lars Von Trier. I haven't really loved any of his movies, though, I don't think. I respect the man, certainly. Haven't seen the serial killer movie yet, though. It's on Hulu now. I think I will soon. Best movie streaming platform, they're all dog shit. It's tremendously awful. Perfect proof that we live in a consumer-oriented society where all of the indignities we're supposed to endure are justified by the fact that they provide us with this limitless choice of dog shit. Man, I haven't seen Repo Man since I was in high school, I don't think. It wasn't one of those movies that stuck with me. I should rewatch it, though. Because I remember watching it I went through the phase, like, I'm going to get culture. I read the books that people said were very good, and I went and saw the good movies that I could get a hold of, and that was one of the, like, this is a cult classic. And I was like, okay, that's fine, but it never really hit me. I got to rewatch it. I've watched Walker more recently, speaking of Alex Cox, than I've seen Repo Man. I will admit now another deficiency. Someone's asking about the Trailer Park Boys. I watched one episode, and I was like, okay, I didn't really watch any more of it. I get that you got to stick with it for a while, but I just didn't feel the need. I didn't have an aching hole. I've seen all the memes, and at no point have I felt I need this in my life. Just preference, man. Just the way things are. You know, in the 20s during Prohibition, people who were in favor of Prohibition were called dries. People who were opposed to it were called wets. So you could say that after 32, the Democrats were officially a wet ass party. For a while, they were a dry ass party. They became a wet ass party eventually. In fact, that was one of the battle over being a wet ass party or a dry ass party. Was one of the things that led to one of the most contentious U.S. Presidential party conventions in history in New York in 1924. It was a battle between the forces of Irish Catholic New York Governor Al Smith, who led the wet-ass party, and William McAdoo, who was the former Treasury Secretary under Wilson from California, who led the dry-ass party. And the wet-ass party was made up of the urban ethnic whites who made up the northern base of the Democrats, and the dry-ass party represented the rural Protestant native whites who were the other half of their coalition. And they went to pick a candidate in 24, and they were essentially evenly matched, and it led to 109 ballots, I believe, which is the most in history. And there were multiple kind of small-scale riots and fistfights over the course of, I think it was over a week. I think it was like 12 days. It was a big disaster. It was like, and meanwhile, the Republicans had a very orderly first ballot nomination of good old Calvin Coolidge in Cleveland, and just won in one of the biggest ass-kickings of the modern era. But then, 4 years later, Smith got the nomination because over time, the dry-ass party lost its organization and its commitment, and people realized nobody actually is liking this prohibition shit anyway, and they became a wet-ass party again. No, I would say Scandinavians and Germans, for the most part, I would not call ethnic whites. Ethnic white usually refers to the last white people to show up. And so you could have called Germans ethnic whites in the early 1900s. Benjamin Franklin famously complained a ton about Germans and how there were too many swarthy Germans running around. And where the hell, is this even America? Where the hell is this place? But by the time the Irish and then the Italians and the like Central Europeans and stuff showed up, they became the ethnic whites. In the Midwest, though, like German Catholics kind of voted like ethnic whites, and they were all vehemently opposed to prohibition, thanks to the beer hall culture. But yeah, Al Smith was a contentious choice, to say the least, when he was the first Catholic nominated by a major party. There was famously a row of burning crosses that were set up for his campaign train to pass, and that was in Long Island. Yeah, the whistle stop tour was fun. They don't do that anymore. You'd think it would be good for Biden. He loves trains, and it'd be a way that they could keep him away from crowds, safe distance. Just have him come into a town, have the train just stop, goes to the caboose, gives a little speech in front of an assembled group of reporters who are all socially distanced, and then takes off again. It'd be fun. More fun than this goddamn Zoom bullshit. But no, thanks to COVID and the fact that he's a million years old, he is taking the William McKinley approach, where you just stay at your house. McKinley famously did not leave his front porch to run for president in 1886. Instead, he had his minion Mark Hanna running around, the guy who was his fixer, bribing everybody from here to Timbuktu in order to make sure that the bimetallist populist freak William Jennings Bryan didn't win. Yeah, in the 19th century, it was considered bad form to want to run for president. And you can chalk that up to silly Victorian manners, but I think there was something to it. I think there was even then a real recognition that if someone would want that job, a job of that much pressure and that much scrutiny, and most importantly, that much power relative to the average citizen, there's got to be something wrong with them. They should only want that job because they're the only one who can do it. And that was all through the 19th century, that was the case. If there was a contested convention, or even if there wasn't, the candidates did not appear at their conventions. That was considered gauche. They sent emissaries to work the floor on their behalf. And they gave the speech if they won, they accepted the speech remotely. And now we have a thing where the presidency is more high pressure, more powerful in terms of its power over life and death, more under more scrutiny than it's ever been, and now we've decided that wanting to be president is not a disqualifying trait in a human being, even though to me it would seem like the most disqualifying trait you could imagine a person to have. I mean, that was like Bernie, one of the semiotic like the loaded things about Bernie that maybe was not really true, but his life story suggested it was true, is that he never wanted to be president. I remember fucking that piece of shit, what's his name? Eric Alterman. He wrote an article about Bernie in 2016 when they were first running the stupid Sandinista thing about how, oh my God, he was at a rally where they were saying death to America. Just because America was illegally mining their harbor and conducting economic warfare and having drug-addicted rapists attack their territory on a fucking daily basis, they're saying death to America? And Alterman was not yet at the point where he can say that he was wrong to be there. You know, official liberal doctrine is still that the Contra War was bad, mostly because it was carried out by a Republican. So they can't say he was wrong to do it. What he said was, it showed bad instincts on Bernie's part that he allowed that to happen. But then you think, well, he was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. You know, he spent the first 40 years of his life as like a partially employed bad carpenter / political activist. And then he was the mayor of Burlington. Do you think he was imagining being president? That kind of thing proves he wasn't. And anyone who is the other way, anyone whose life choices are entirely conditioned upon what will lead them up the ladder, has a life that is a horrifying thing that we should all unjustly be revolted by. And yet, we act like the desire to be president is not absolutely disqualifying to the position. Amazing. It's because I guess you're supposed to take their word for it that they really believe that they're the only one who can do it. And I mean, with Bernie, you've got an argument because he's, you know, the only like uncorrupted social democrat to try to run for the presidency in 40 years. But if you're like a standard issue Democrat, what the hell personal thing could you possibly have that no one else does that would make you uniquely suited for this monstrosity, this moral crime of a job? Stick-to-itiveness? You understand that the strength of America is the strength of Americans or whatever fucking horseshit? Foe out of here. Kindly foe out of here, please. Poor Donald Trump. Like, Donald Trump is one of those people who wanted to be president, and that proves him as evil, but of course he only wanted to be elected president. He just wanted to be elected. And then he had to do it, and it proved not fun, like everything else he's ever done. Oops. Well, the thing about Napoleon is he actually was as talented as he thought he was, or near to it. Obviously, he was not quite as talented as he thought he was, or he would not have done what he did there at the end. And along the way, too, he had a number of fuck-ups. But he was much closer in his estimation of himself than anybody, any of these people could possibly be now. And partially it's because, what did Napoleon do? At every step, he assumed his own ability to do something, and then he did it. He assumed, yeah, I can lead an army into Italy and just rout the fucking Austrians. And then he fucking did it. Yeah, I can take over. I can go. I mean, Egypt was not a success, but he was not personally defeated at any point beyond being able to stop the to successfully seize Acre. He still got a hell of a lot closer than anybody else. And, you know, eventually he reached the level of his incompetence when he got started to get owned. And it was to his detriment that he didn't recognize that in time. But the average career path of a politician with a Napoleonic fixation on their own ambition, what? You got elected dog catcher on a platform of fiscal responsibility? And then, what, you took some money from your fucking father-in-law to run for House in a district that's shaped like it was made by somebody having a stroke? And then, what, you got appointed to a Senate seat by the governor or something because you saved him from choking on a chicken bone at a party fundraiser? And you're going to act like you're fucking Napoleon marching across the Alps? Kindly foe. Because none of these guys have anything... None of these guys have ever done anything but worm their way through the political bureaucracy. Exactly. If the level of, if the Peter Principle gets you to be Lord Paramount of all of Europe, you're up there. So yeah, I would not mind the ambitions of someone who had their ambitions tested. Because if you fail, well, we don't have to hear from you ever again. Yeah, everyone thinks they're Napoleon, and at best they're Napoleon III. And still most of them could not pass that bar by a significant margin. All right, guys. I'm peacing out. I'll talk soon. Bye-bye.